Trigger warning, this podcast episode features discussions of emotional and narcissistic abuse. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Emotional Abuse is Real. I'm your host, Serene Leeds. I'm a professional writer and storyteller, and I'm so glad you're here. I'm so excited to share today's episode with you. My guest is Bridget Binns, a successful culinary writer whose new memoir, Rotten Kid, A Succulent Story of Survival, is now available. As the daughter of Hollywood character actor Edward Binns, Bridget led, to the outside observer, a charmed life. But under that shiny California veneer was a dark secret. Bridget was being emotionally abused by her narcissistic mother, Marcia Binns. As always, before we get into today's episode, I have a few announcements. Okay, you guys, I cannot believe I'm saying these words out loud. Emotional Abuse is Real is 1 year old. We officially launched on March 8th, 2023, and here we are, 43 episodes and 8,000 plus downloads later. I am so grateful to everyone who has supported the show over the past year, listeners and guests alike. As the podcast moves into its second year, I'm looking to dedicate episodes to more niche topics that fall under the emotional abuse umbrella, and I'm planning to kick things off with a series devoted to toxic work environments. If you're a regular listener to this podcast, then you already know that my emotional abuse story stems from my toxic boss and my apathetic coworkers. If you have a toxic workplace story you'd like to share, I'd love to hear from you. Whether you experienced toxic workplace culture, a toxic boss, or a toxic coworker, or even all three. Shoot me a DM on Instagram at Serene Leeds Writes, that's SareneLeedsWrites, and don't forget to follow me while you're at it, or via email at hello@sereneleedswrites.com. I've left this information in the show notes as well. Also, please make sure you're subscribed to this podcast on either Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can support Emotional Abuse is Real by leaving a 5-star rating and writing a review over on Apple Podcasts. Another way to connect with me in this podcast is through my email list, which you can subscribe to by downloading my free resource, 10 Things I Learned from Getting Paid to Watch TV. This download is a collection of some of my best writing tips and tricks, all of which I learned from covering television. I've left the link for you in the show notes. This is also your friendly reminder that if you're a listener and you'd like to share your story on Emotional Abuse is Real, please don't hesitate to reach out via Instagram DM or via email at hello@sereneleedswrites.com. Anonymous guests are always welcome. So I had an absolute blast talking with Bridget Binns on today's episode. I highly encourage you to pick up a copy of Rotten Kid, A Succulent Story of Survival, because even though we mainly talk about the emotional abuse she endured at the hands of her mother, that is just one layer of the wild ride that has been Bridget's life. From her globetrotting adventures as a young adult in the 1970s to her tumultuous Europe-based marriage in the 1980s to her emergence as a renowned culinary writer, there is something for everyone in this memoir. Plus, fellow fans of Feud, Capote versus the Swans, will definitely want to stick around for our brief chat about the Dishy FX series. So, without further ado, here's my conversation with Bridget Binns.
Hi, Serene. It's lovely to be here. And I am Bridget Binns, and I live in Central California, and I've written a whole bunch of cookbooks, plus a memoir.
Yes, you have. And that's why you're here. And I am so excited that you're here. I just finished reading your memoir titled Rotten Kid, A Succulent Story of Survival. And I just want you to know how much I loved it. The book focuses on your childhood as the daughter of a successful Hollywood actor, your globetrotting young adulthood, marriage and divorce, and your burgeoning career as a culinary writer. Thank you so much for telling this roller coaster of a story.
Well, you know, some of my friends have said, oh, you're so brave, Bridget. And I think I always say to myself, yeah, either that or stupid.
No, you're not stupid. You're not stupid at all.
Thank you for saying that.
We need stories like this. We need more and more stories like this. And I'm always very happy whenever I read a story or hear a story from someone who is willing to be completely honest, because that's all we have. At the end of the day, all we have is the truth. So I think that that's extremely important.
Well, I really do agree with that. I mean, this book was in the back of my head for a long time. I actually started it in Marfa in 2009. And I thought, Oh, I'll go to Marfa. I'll get some secluded little bungalow with my dog and I'll do some quality work, because there's so much artistic talent floating around in the air in Marfa. And that I got basically zero done, because I was convinced that the Texas Chainsaw Massacre was going to happen in my bungalow, because the heater was making these clanking noises. And I just, you know, I just couldn't. And also my mother was still alive then. So that was sort of putting the brakes on. And also there is, as you know, having read the book, there's some stuff about an ex-governor of California. And at the time, his son was still the governor of California. So I didn't feel that it was quite ready. And so I put everything into a Walmart box and stuck it in the back of the closet and didn't touch it until the pandemic.
I get it. I totally get that was your reasoning, but at least you got started. And now we have this wonderful book for everyone to enjoy. And I mean, I don't mean to laugh when you say things about, like, you thought it was the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I'm just remembering reading that part of the book. So now there are a lot of layers to this memoir, but due to the content of this podcast, I do want to focus on the one layer that will have a direct impact on our listeners, many of whom are survivors of emotional and narcissistic abuse. And that layer is your mother. Started off a little on a broad scale. How would you describe your relationship with your mother?
My relationship with my mother was essentially shitty. Mm-hmm. But I also admired her, which is one of those drawbacks. Yeah. And I think is a factor for a lot of narcissists, in that they are very compelling. Their personalities are very glamorous, compelling, funny, engaging. Mm-hmm. And so as a kid, you look at that larger than life figure and you think, oh, I can never be as cool as my mom. And then to have her basically dislike me, disapprove, be constantly disappointed in me, that was like saying, well, the most important person in my life thinks I'm a loser, so therefore I must be a loser. And that's basically the gist of the entire progression for me, was to try to find a way out of that trap. And it was certainly therapy, and it was certainly geographic distance was helpful, but you know, it doesn't really matter, because there's always the telephone. And when you have an angry, self-involved woman armed with a telephone and a typewriter, you can't escape.
Yeah. You know, I was waiting for you to mention the typewriter, because you mention a lot of her letters to you in the book. And even though the content of those letters were, for a reader such as myself, just so upsetting, they were still such compelling letters. And that's what makes people like your mother such fascinating characters, so to speak.
Fascinating and scary. She certainly was a good writer, but she sadly had so little of her own self-esteem for various reasons that she never really wrote anything other than endless personal correspondence, much of which was really scathing and nasty and judgmental, yeah. as you saw. I mean, I did feel I couldn't get my message truly across unless I included some of those letters in the book. And I'm glad that the publishers allowed me to do that.
Yeah, I think that they make a huge difference because it's so hard when you're writing a book. You can only tell your side of the story, but by showcasing those letters, that's all the proof that you need. Yeah.
And it's funny you say all the proof that you need, because as a kid growing up with no self-confidence, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. up until my late 20s, mid 30s, I was constantly making excuses for why I didn't like my mother, why I took a break here and there for a couple of years. We would have a fight and people would say, well, why can't you get along with your mother? And so I was constantly having to come up with these stories. Like, for instance, I don't think as a kid I truly realized that I had an abnormal childhood. But there was this one time my dad booked a gig on Hawaii Five-0, mm-hmm. and went to Honolulu to shoot it. And yeah. even though this never really happened, my mother and I went to join him at the end of it. And they put us up at the Kahala Hilton. I'm 12, right?
Right.
So I was like, mom, somebody put an orchid on my pillow and there's porpoises in the swimming pool. And I was just blown away. I didn't know. And so, okay. So really nice. And then when we left, they both flew first class and they sent me standby.
Yeah.
And I didn't get on the flight. So I sat alone in the Honolulu airport for about 6 hours before I could get on another flight. And I just, you know, was reading A Wrinkle in Time. Mm-hmm. And, but then I saw all these kids getting on the plane with their parents.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, maybe that's the way this is supposed to go. Maybe this isn't entirely normal.
Yeah, you know, you predicted my next question was when did you start realizing that how you were being treated by your mother wasn't exactly healthy? I mean, I'm really glad you brought up that example, because I do remember that from the book. And I was just like, you know, I mean, there would be cases where your parents would fly first class and you would be in coach and even something like this, they just went on ahead without you, which as a parent in 2024, I read this and I'm like, wait a minute. I would be deemed a neglectful mother if I did something like that to my kid. It's really amazing. So yeah, I just wanted to know there are other moments when you realize, okay, maybe this isn't right. Yeah.
You know, I was feisty from a very early age. I knew I didn't have any cousins. Mm-hmm. I had two older half sisters, but they never lived with us.
Right.
So I didn't see a lot of other kids' childhoods up close. Although I had some friends and I would go over there and I was like, oh my God, you can have cereal? You can have 7-Up? You can watch TV? This is amazing. But that was just, you know, normal kid stuff. I'm being deprived because I can't have Lucky Charms for breakfast. but I did become feisty. Somehow there was a part of me that knew that she wasn't being fair. And I would say that when I was 11 and she told me that my father was impotent and that for that reason, she had taken a lover, a
right.
Mr. X.
Yes.
I thought, that's probably not normal. I mean, it's Hollywood, right? So,
right.
So things are a little more laissez-faire, but still, that's not something that an 11-year-old needs to know. I think she wanted me to be her friend. She didn't want to mother me. She wanted to have a little accessory, a little mini me that would follow her around and think she was fabulous. And when I fought back, it did not go well for me.
Yeah, I get that. And I hear that story a lot on this podcast about when the victims or the survivors, so to speak, are ready to fight back and they're ready to stand up for themselves. And the abuser is quite taken aback and doesn't know where any of that is coming from. So yeah. And I also, you know, because you do talk about your mother's history, and I have seen this because there have been a number of people on this podcast. So up until now, and we talk about how the older generations, how we all try to improve upon what they did. But I think that this went beyond just a low self-esteem issue when it came to your mother.
I mean, well, she was an only child as well. And her mother was a single mom in the mid-1920s.
Yeah, and that's rare.
So there, it was also a major socialist. Mm-hmm. And so her upbringing was a little bit odd. She had no father. And she was constantly, I think, trying to overcompensate for that. And so I do have certainly compassion for her as a child. And also being hospitalized with a mastoid infection from age 2 to age 4 is pretty traumatic for a little only child whose mother is working full time. I understand to a certain extent, and thank goodness I do, because I wouldn't want to be left with nothing but hate. I want to have some compassion, and I do. I definitely do.
No doubt. And that definitely comes through in the book. And I wanted to ask you, so how did you ultimately make peace with your mom? Even if this happened in your own head.
Thank you for illuminating that last point. Yeah. Because I did not really make peace with her until she was on her deathbed.
Right.
But in my own mind, I made the peace after some therapy, to be honest. A wonderful therapist whom we went to see together at first because she wanted to try to understand why her child hated her. And I said, well, why don't you go to the therapist by yourself 6 times first, and then I'll join you because, you know, then you can get the therapist on your side first before I turn up. Yeah. And Kate, the therapist, was truly wonderful, although my mother couldn't hack it. She just couldn't. She would burst into tears in the sessions. And then eventually I said, I don't see why we should keep doing this because it's making you unhappy. Mm-hmm. And so then the bonus is that I continued to see Kate afterwards by myself. And one thing she said, even when we were still in the sessions together, she said, your daughter felt like an employee who could be fired at any time. So just zero lack of security, you know, no feeling that there was any kind of unconditional love or approval and so when that happened, when I did the therapy with Kate, and I also, it was right around the time that I published my first cookbook. It was like a huge weight was lifted off of my shoulders because I realized that there was nothing that I could do to change her opinion of me and that I had to let it go. I had to stop taking it so seriously. And if there's a message, I've received so many DMs and stuff from people who've seen the pre-release ads and saying, oh my God, I wish I could talk to you. Can I take you to lunch? I so feel about your story. And if there's one message that I could send, it would be, it's not your fault.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you so much for saying that. Absolutely. Because that's a message that I'm certainly trying to convey with this podcast. And yes, I wanted to make it absolutely clear that when I say make peace, I wanted it I meant in your head, because I did read the section of the book when your mother did pass away. And And I understand where you're coming from, because that actually sounds very similar to my relationship with my grandmother. We had one of those like deathbed moments where the poor thing was in such pain, and she immediately just said she was so sorry for everything. But it wasn't until afterward and therapy and a lot of time and reflection that I've been able to make peace with our differences. And I also want to thank you for saying what you did about therapy, because since I'm not a mental health professional, I like to make it very clear on this podcast that therapy is critical.
I really think it is. I mean, you can learn things from reading books about narcissism and Mommy Dearest, for instance.
Yes, absolutely.
But you can't really truly apply it to yourself unless you have the wonderful luxury of a professional who is listening to your particular story and helping you get over those. And it can take some time. Oh, yeah. And also, you can think that you're all better. And then, I mean, there's one thing I want to touch on.
Please.
Just for a moment. And that is, I think that infidelity is something that none of us expect or imagine in our lives.
Yeah.
But as the child of a self-involved narcissistic person, it just raises all those issues that you have worked so hard to get rid of, to get beyond. And you think, I truly am not worthy. I am a loser. Nobody would ever want to be with me. And it all comes roaring back. And so you're far more vulnerable to, and it could be another type of rejection too. It could be getting fired. So it's not just infidelity, but these are the things that I think normal kids have better weapons or arsenal of ways to get through this kind of rejection, which is not a reflection on you in general.
Yeah.
But it's very traumatic.
I'm really glad that you brought that up, because I did think about that in the section of your book where your marriage really did end, and it ended due to infidelity. And I was thinking about how you seemed so independent and self-sufficient. You knew in the back of your mind that the relationship was over anyway. But then when that infidelity hit, all of those triggers came flooding back.
So, that's exactly what it is. They're triggers, and you can't avoid them, I don't think, unless you are a preternaturally powerful person, which most kids of narcissists just aren't.
Yeah. So you had therapy, but also I just wanted to talk to you about how writing this particular memoir was part of your healing process.
It was cathartic to an extent, mm-hmm. although I had done the work earlier, years earlier, I had done that work, but then I think you need distance in order to be able to write about something like this. And so when I eventually had the distance, and then the people who could have been hurt were no longer with us, I felt the pandemic gave me the permission to sit down and get it done and pull out all of those letters, which, you know, I don't really think that she imagined that this is what would happen with all those carbon copies that she kept for all those decades.
Yeah.
But it certainly was helpful to me in putting it all together. And she had letters from me too, which didn't always make me feel particularly proud of myself because I was fighting. I mean, I was fighting her. It was good to get it on paper, as it were. And I feel like if even one person is helped by reading a story of unsinkable optimism in the face of a difficult time. You know, I think what I would say is, people are going to probably say, oh, well, Hollywood childhood, it's so entitled, it's so privileged. It doesn't matter. because no. All that glitters is not gold. And no matter where you live, no matter what your socioeconomic situation is, you can be profoundly hurt. And I just wanted to share that story. And plus, I love sentences.
And there are a lot of them in the book.
I call myself a sentence wrangler. You know, I just can't leave it alone. I guess, wait, I could just pick, maybe a little alliteration here or there. And so I had fun writing it too. And good. I wanted to communicate that I found many of these situations darkly funny.
Okay, like what?
Well, the ironies of I'm not sure how to answer that.
Yeah.
But I think you have to laugh, you know, when I was in the Grand Canyon.
Yes.
For 3 weeks.
Yes.
With a tarp and some trail mix.
Yeah.
And a bunch of wiry guys, this was a school thing.
Right.
One of my 7 boarding schools.
Right.
I wrote my mother a letter about her lamb stew.
Yes.
And that's the darkly funny irony that I find in these stories is that no matter how much she made me feel terrible and I had to write 2 letters every month, otherwise I wouldn't get my allowance.
That's right. Yeah. But
this was just a letter that I felt like writing because I was sick of trail mix for one thing, but it was acknowledging something about her that I admired. And this is the story, you know, you can't just hate every, and I honestly wouldn't use the word hate. Maybe when I was 15 or 16, I might've said that I hated her, but now I wouldn't use that word. I didn't admire 50% of her.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I disliked the 50% of her. But then there were other things. She taught me to value food and cooking. She taught me to be an international traveler.
Yeah.
And she taught me to have something of an ironic sense of humor.
Well, there is no trace of hate that certainly comes across in the book. Like I said, just honesty. And because some of the loveliest sections of the book have to do with food and international travel, because even though there are just some heartbreaking passages in this book, I absolutely loved all of your globetrotting adventures because I'm a travel buff. How original. Because I love traveling. And also because I love cooking. I'm really happy
There is much to love. There is much to love.
Absolutely. So I'm so glad that you included all of that in the book. So apart from the section covering your mother's death, which was, 2011?
Yes.
2011. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it does feel like that the memoir kind of ends, you know, just as your culinary writing career is taking off. So is there a part 2 in the works?
I don't know. It takes time to get the kind of distance that you need from happenings. And the point of this for me was that I became something. I mean, I had worked on Wall Street before and I had majored in Chinese studies and I learned to speak some Chinese, but I had never really accomplished anything professional before. So that felt like the right place to end it, that we were on the beginning. We had come to the end of a phase and we were at the beginning of another phase. Whether there will be more, I don't really No, because I'm actually a very private person. who knew?
Well, maybe you're a private person for just one section of your life.
Yes. And, you know, when my dad was I mean, I would call him maybe a B-list actor. He was the kind of guy that got recognized in the supermarket all the time, but nobody ever knew his name. Like, aren't you that guy on TV? I know you. What's your name? What's your name? And sometimes he would say, well, I'm just Bridget's dad.
Oh, he was, we would call him now, hey, it's that guy.
Yes, indeed. But, you know, when he was a popular actor, he had fans.
Sure.
And they would send him, there's these photo albums that somebody, this woman in the Midwest somewhere, took pictures off of the television, mounted them with those cute little, you know, corner thingies, those little white corner thingies.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah.
Put them in a bunch of albums and sent them, and just the sweetest people. But these days, there are a small subset of fans who are not quite so well adjusted, shall I say? Mm-hmm. And my current husband is an actor, and we have been the target of online bullying and harassment.
So sorry.
It's really awful. It's just unnecessary and cruel and very difficult to figure out.
I agree. What's the point? I'm so sorry to hear that. You know, it's really interesting. So my background is actually in entertainment journalism. So when I was growing up, I just thought that everyone in the entertainment industry were the most fascinating people in the world. And I just wanted to meet everyone and hope to become friends with everyone. When I became an entertainment journalist and I got to know people and I saw, hey, this is their job. It just looks a little bit more glamorous than everyone else's. I really was able to better understand why you should never put anyone up on a pedestal. And I personally just get really upset when I see how unhealthy certain fans can behave.
Yeah. It's so, very sad. It's a symbol of people who don't much care for their own lives.
And it's true. It's true. And I've been witnessing this for a very long time, and it affects my enjoyment mm-hmm. of things that I love. Like I always give this example. I've been a huge fan of the band U2 for forever, but I can't, it's so hard for me to enjoy their live performances anymore because I know a lot of these fans, and it's just, it's like, guys, Bono is not your friend. He may act like he is, but he's not. And as a journalist, I've witnessed this for a very long time. So thank you for sharing that. And I'm sorry.
Yeah, I thank you. You know, there's a writer named Alyssa Altman who mm-hmm. wrote Motherland. And she just did a podcast recently with an author from England, Catherine, can't remember her last name, but has written a book about her autistic child. And they did a podcast about boundaries. And it was fascinating and interesting, I think, for you as well, because one of the things that when Catherine published her book about her autistic child, the editor said to her, have you disabled your DMs yet? And she said, well, why would I do that? I'm getting all kinds of really interesting feedback, although it is time consuming because everybody wants to tell their own story. But, you know, you want to help if you can. Yeah. However, we are not professionals. Mm-hmm. And the editor said to her, what are you going to do if you get a suicide threat?
Yeah.
And the thing is that when people read your memoir or see you performing on stage or in a TV show, they think they know you.
Yeah. Yep.
And that is, I think, a big problem. We as artists put ourselves out there because we have something that we want to share.
Yeah.
And we think either it is a piece of art in some way, or it's something that will resonate with other people and might even help them. But it's a little disconcerting when somebody comes up to you in the grocery store and says, so how was that pork chop last night?
Yeah.
And you're thinking, yeah. Oh yeah, I did do that. But it's the world, the digital world, is a big empty screen
it is.
With a ton of people on the other side of it.
It's true. It's so true. It really, really is. And this is the huge downside to our digital world now. I'm glad we were able to discuss it, even though this podcast is about emotional abuse. Trust me, I cover a lot of different topics in my career. So I'm glad that you brought it up, and thank you. So there was actually another area of your book that I did want to bring up as a Jewish person. So just to set the stage a little. So I am a person who has struggled with her Jewish identity over the years. So I was quite fascinated with the section of the book where you discovered that you were indeed Jewish. Your maternal grandmother was Jewish, which in turn made your mother and you Jewish. But your grandmother chose to hide this aspect of her identity, which impacted both your mother and you. So where does Jewishness fall within your identity now?
You know, Serene, it's hard because I was so angry when I first found out, and my first impulse was to blame my mother. And it was at a time when I was very unhappy with her anyway.
Right.
And so this was just kind of like the nail in the coffin.
Sure.
Because I said, well, wow, you mean I could have had a bunch of fun cousins? And I mean, I went to bat mitzvahs and bar mitzvahs when I was growing up in Beverly Hills, and I thought we were bleeding heart liberals. I mean, what's the point?
Right.
But it was as soon as I started to do some more research, I realized that it was my grandmother that had, unfortunately, she passed away when I was six. So I didn't get to know her, which is a great heartbreak to me because I think she would have been the missing piece in my relationship with my mother.
Yeah.
But I was... it's hard to become Jewish when you're 35.
I get that.
I mean, I did say I had a boyfriend who was Jewish, and I thought to myself, I could marry him. It would be fine. I'm Jewish.
Yeah.
But I don't, and I have a wonderful Jewish friend in Chicago who counsels me on how to light the candles when necessary and stuff. But I had no religion growing up, zero religion. And so my dad was a Quaker, but I never went to a Quaker meeting. I know what they look like, but there was just zero. I went to Sunday school, I think, three times when I was about 6 or 8 years old, and they gave us candy. And so then I couldn't go anywhere. She said I wasn't allowed to go, but I really liked the Bible, the illuminated pictures of Jesus with the really long hair, because I was into hippies and boys with long hair. So
he had the look.
He had the look, man. Those blue look, eyes, man. that long wavy hair, you know. But no, it's not. It's something I'm aware of, and I wanted to do the research. She wouldn't let me. But I did eventually make my way to Cousin Audrey in Chappaqua.
Guess who grew up in Chappaqua?
No, really?
Hello.
Audrey. Yes. And so when I reached out to her, I found her through no help from my mother. Mm-hmm. And she was so loving and wonderful and accepting and funny. And she invited my husband and I to her 50th wedding anniversary, and we were living in upstate New York at the time, not quite briefly, but we went, and it was just amazing. I made all these friends. I met people that were sort of semi-family, and I loved it. And it just made me realize how much I missed out on.
But
as a religious way, it doesn't really affect me that much.
Right.
Except that I have regrets, and I would like to go to Drobnin in Poland at some point, if that is ever possible, where my maternal great-grandfather had a pushcart.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But unfortunately, half of that family stayed behind.
Yeah.
And the other half came here in 1898.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I when I asked the question, I certainly did not expect you to turn around and say, oh yeah, it's a huge, you know, the religion is a huge part of my life. Like you said, once, you know, once you're 35 or once you're an adult, it's very hard to change those kinds of fundamental beliefs that you have. But I just did find that to be yet another fascinating piece of your life, and to share, my family is from Poland as well. But they all left. They were all here by 1920. So we were very, very fortunate. We were very, if I had anyone in the Holocaust, they would have been the siblings of my great grandparents.
That's what my situation was.
I see. Okay.
And I don't have any particular names, but I do know that there were the Berlin family, mm-hmm. and the, that was my grandmother's side. And they actually had a family characteristic mm-hmm. of starting to get white hair very, very early in life.
Yeah. Yeah.
And all of the Berlin sisters had a shock of white hair in the center of their forehead by their 20s.
Mm.
And I just wonder what happened.
Yeah.
To those two sisters married two brothers, that I know.
Oh.
This I know. And I have a tree thing from Israel whereby the five Berlin sisters that emigrated to Mount Vernon, New York, mm-hmm. bought a tree in honor of their parents, Chaskal and Gittel Fenningstein.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Right.
And so I have that scroll thingy.
Okay.
And when they got here, they changed their names to Charles and Kate Fenningston.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, my name leads. No, that is not.
Not the original
at all. But all the towns that you've been mentioning, Mount Vernon, Chappaqua, those are all here where I live in Westchester County. So I know those areas.
I've never been to, I know the address of, well, I'm sure the house isn't there anymore, but I know the address from ancient correspondence that every single woman in my family has been a hoarder of correspondence. So I know what the address is.
Yeah.
But I've never even been there.
Yeah. So, Well, I'm really happy that we were able to discuss that part of
it. It was very traumatic for her.
Sure. For her. Yeah. Sure.
She was really angry.
Yeah.
That I had found out, because I think her goal was to erase Jewishness from her family in one generation. And I couldn't understand it. It was like somebody had dumped a bucket of ice water over her head.
Yeah.
What's the problem?
Right. I mean, I can only assume that those were the feelings that she had inherited from her own mother.
That's hard for me to realize or to acknowledge, but I think you are probably very right.
I mean, and that's coming entirely from your book. I don't have any other information. So,
but it's hard for me to imagine my grandmother being so small-minded like that. But wait a second. Let's remember that she was a single mother in 1927 with no job and a tiny child, and she had to get a job. And she was petrified that she would be fired.
Yeah.
And she worked at the waspiest department store
right.
in Los Angeles, Bullock's Wilshire.
Right.
And she came home every night and said, they're going to fire me. They're going to find out. They're going to fire me. So I have to have some sympathy for her. I mean, this is not the 1930s right now.
No.
And that world that she lived in was not safe.
No. Well, one could argue that it's kind of getting there, but there is a difference. Yeah,
I fear you may be right.
Yeah, that's a whole different conversation, of course. But
you
know, it's interesting because my grandparents' attitude from the post-war, they did not want anyone straying from from Judaism, the reason why my grandmother and I ultimately needed to have that deathbed reconciliation is because your girl married a wonderful Puerto Rican who was raised Catholic, but who was still very proudly Jewish.
Right. But I mean, you can see their point, right? Because they're seeing the tribe shrinking.
That's exactly what it was. And they couldn't see any other way of living.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think that, I mean, my mother's father, my maternal grandfather, was a French Canadian Catholic, and who paid absolutely no attention to religion either.
Yeah.
And they all that family from Mount Vernon, those five girls, all but one of them became socialists and moved to California. So you can see that their parents might have been a little miffed.
Yeah, but I find like those kinds of stories are so universal, no matter what generation, no matter where you come from.
I mean, basically my big exposure to the Jewish faith was in reading Mishner's The Source when I was in my early 20s. And I was like, oh my God, it's such a great story. But I didn't know yet at that point. Right.
Yeah, no, I get that. So I want us to make sure that we wrap up on a bit of a lighter note, because I meant to ask you, because I was poking around your Instagram and I saw you had shared a photo from the current FX series feud, Capote versus the Swans. And I just wanted to know, are you just a fan or are you affiliated with that show? Because I have an article up on Vulture all about it.
Oh, I'll have to check that out. I absolutely will. You know, my connection with that show is that Slim Keith,
yes,
moved in next door to my mother's barn in Connecticut.
Okay.
And they became friends. Then I read Slim's autobiography, I guess, mm-hmm. which I love because she was just such a feisty woman. Mm-hmm. And then there were all kinds of connections in the theater world. You know, Lauren Bacall was her image was created to imitate Slim Keith.
Yeah.
Who had been Slim Hayward before that. And that's, I love watching. It's a great show. I can't wait to read your Vulture piece. But when Slim was living next door to my mother, there was a little bridge over the creek, the East Aspetuck. And because the property had once been one property instead of two when it was owned by Frederick March and his wife Florence, and then their children grew up and they sold half of it to my mother because she was a friend of the Marches. So they split it into two, and then Slim Keith bought the main house. And so they would trundle across the bridge with their martini shakers and stuff. And I think my mother imagined that it was a much tighter friendship than it really was.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Well, thank you for sharing that story. Yeah, because I was looking around. I was like, oh, I think she's watching Capote versus the Swans, which is like a big part of my life, like early in this year because I was working on this article. But yeah, it's available on Vulture. It's just a comparison between the character portrayal and the
real world. I can't wait.
Yes.
And I've read lots of books about that particular time and those particular people, because when I was growing up, my mother was constantly raving about Babe Paley. Babe Paley is the coolest. She's the one. She's the top, the bee's knees.
Right. Right. Yeah. And I, for the most part, didn't know who most of these people were. So that's one of the reasons why I wanted to write the article. Obviously, I was a huge fan of Truman Capote's growing up, but I didn't know about his relationship with these women. So yeah, it was fascinating work. It was just a fascinating time working on that article. So, but anyway, it has been such a pleasure talking to you. I just want to give you an opportunity to mention to the listeners how they can connect with you.
Well, thank you, Serene. I knew this was going to be fun because I've listened to some of your other podcasts, so I knew it would be fun, but I didn't realize quite how much fun it would be. So I appreciate the chance to chit chat with you, and we could probably go on forever.
No doubt.
My website is bridgetbins.com, BRIGITBINNS.com. The book is available on bookshop.org, which is a great way to support your indie booksellers, or obviously on Amazon and Rotten Kid on Amazon. I do have a Substack, Rotten Kid, which I'm having a lot of fun with right now. And I'm publishing on Substack a lot of the color versions of the black and white pictures that are in the book, and also with little bits of extra info on there. So I'm having really a blast with Substack.
Wonderful. All right. Well, I will be sure to leave links to all of those in the show notes. The book is titled Rotten Kid, A Succulent Story of Survival. Bridget Binns, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. It really was a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, Serene. What fun we've had.
Certainly have. Thank you for listening to my conversation with Bridget Binns on Emotional Abuse is Real. If you would like to connect with Bridget or purchase her book, Rotten Kid, A Succulent Story of Survival, I've left links for you in the show notes. If you would like to share your own emotional abuse story here on the podcast, please don't hesitate to reach out via email at hello@sereneleadsrights.com or through Instagram at sereneleadsrights. Please note that this podcast should not be used as a substitute for professional mental health services. If you are a victim of emotional abuse and need help, please call or text the Suicide and Crisis Hotline at 988 or call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-7233. You can also text START, S-T-A-R-T, to 88788. Once again, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts, follow me on Instagram, and go grab my free download, 10 Things I Learned from Getting Paid to Watch TV. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.